Well, last Sunday, Edmé talked about pain. It got me thinking. So I wanted to take off from sort of where we left off talking about suffering. I was thinking first about pain. I was thinking about how we experience things and sensations. I was thinking about wine. Now, we think that this flavor is in this glass of wine, in this purple stuff, but actually all the flavor, it isn't actually happening there, it's happening here, right? Take it in, here's where there's this thing about, oh, this flavor, the chocolate note, the raspberry, oh my God, that's vinegar. Well, is that happening there? Well, no, actually, you know, a lot of that's, it's actually, I'm tasting the wine, I could just pour it in there, we're tasting it. So there's three things going on, there's this grape juice, sorry, Terry, and there's the mouth and nose having responses, and then there's the brain, then there's the memories, and then there's the ideas about it, and then there's all this stuff going on there. And that's just a simple external little purple stuff. And it's easy, it's kind of comforting to say, that tastes like this. So then you have pain. You can't, there's nothing outside there. It's not that thing there. It's this thing here. So the object is me, and then the sensation is here, and then the brain is here, and it's very complicated. And as Edmé was talking about how much is going on in the brain, quite apart from what's going on, in a sense, apart from what's going on in the body. One person drinks that wine and there's no chocolate or raspberry, whatever other floral notes, whatever else. One person says, ooh, that's awful and sour. Another one says, the same one, no, that's smooth and elegant. You know? And so with pain, we can have pain now about something that happened a long time ago. We can have pain now about, we can have phantom limb pain. We can have pain now where there isn't a current physical event happening. We don't even need the grape juice to taste our pain. And that's just pain. And that's just the physical object. When it gets to be what we call suffering, which is happening so much in our awareness, our unawareness, in our body-mind, it gets very complicated. Pain is a very strong force, you know, an implacable force, and yet it's malleable. It's endlessly changing, and that was part of what she was talking about, how powerful it is, and yet how it shifts and changes, and our along with our perception of it, or in our perception of it, there's a lot of what there is to it. Now, suffering is huge, a huge topic. Why am I tackling that one? No, in some ways the centerpiece of Buddhism. We have the Four Noble Truths. You know, suffering, or dukkha, translated as suffering. Suffering or the dissatisfactions, not petulant, the dissatisfactions, the unsatisfactoriness of life. And the origins of it, and the possibility of ending it and the remedies for it. The whole Four Noble Truths are all about suffering. And you turn to another basic teaching, you've got the three marks of existence, that all human existence anyway, all existence of all living things, maybe mostly human in this case, are characterized by their transience, lack of a solid, permanent core self, and suffering. Unsatisfactoriness, dukkha. It's a huge issue for all living things. I was thinking, well, okay, maybe rocks don't cry. But they seem to moan and rub and they make noises. You can be anthropomorphized that. They certainly change and move and are changed. I mean, I've read an article recently that kind of tosses out, we can all choose what we eat and for what reason, but the arguments we've all had, the ideas we've all had that animals suffer in a way that plants don't, are, turns out we're anthropomorphizing there too. we're not able to speak their language. That is to say, they don't have our kind of pain, but they're having a ooh reaction when something bad for the organism happens, and responding, the organism responding. Plants, carrots are doing this. So they have something represent, something like, but different from what we know as pain, but not completely different. So the reason Buddhism pays so much attention to suffering is that it's our universal disease, or it's universal when we think of it as our disease. But the other reason is that Buddhism says there's something you can do about it. Edme quoted one of my very favorite koans. It's from the Blue Cliff Record, in which Master Yunmen says, "Medicine and disease cover the entire earth. The whole earth is medicine. What is yourself? Where are you? Do you know yourself as medicine? Do you know yourself as disease? Do you know how to see medicine and disease everywhere?" I say, "Oh, Gaddafi, that's disease." We had a discussion about that. You know, someone else says, "Oh, that's medicine, but that's disease." Well, but they're both living, suffering beings. The whole earth is medicine and disease. So I thought, well, okay, this is rather a huge topic, and what I want to do today is just disentangle some of the threads, and maybe continue on another day. Different kinds of suffering, and in a sense, different kinds of remedies. So one of the classic models in Buddhism of suffering that's very useful, if provisional, all these devices, three marks of existence. Well, you know, some schools say there's four noble truths. There could be five. They're empty sets. This is what emptiness means. It's very useful to say, oh, you know, there are some really essential marks of characteristics of existence. And whether you defined it as today is three and tomorrow is four is really not the point. Is it a useful set of three? Does it get you somewhere when you see something by provisionally saying, ah, yes, existence is transitory and lacking a solid self, okay. But it's not, somehow, these things are not absolutes. You know, the chain, 12-fold chain of causation, well, you know, there were 14 chains in some schools, links in the chain, and 11 in others. So we have to hold these things a little loosely. Anyway, this is a classic model around suffering as sort of three aspects, really, in a way. Differentiated sort of by their cause, how they happen. There's suffering caused by resistance to pain. And there's suffering caused by emotions and intellect. That really is happening in our mind response. And then there's a kind of existential suffering caused by the naturally intersecting forces of life. So suffering caused by resistance to pain is purely personal. This is happening in me. That's purely an individual personal event. Suffering caused by emotional conflict, psychological suffering, is called the suffering of attachment. It's relational. I want or I don't want. I want what I don't have. I don't want what I have. These are kind of relational. Attachment is not in the modern sense of psychology, where attachment means the ability to care. This is attachment as clinging. And then this third underlying kind of suffering that I've debated endlessly with Katagiri and Tozen and other teachers is really caused by life. So my starting point thinking about this really was Annette's comment last Sunday. She made a very good point about this first kind of pain, really, though they aren't really separate, you know. Suffering caused by resistance to pain. She's a chaplain. She's dealing with people in pain in the hospital. Now there's the physical pain of what's going on, and then there's the emotional pain around the physical pain, which we call suffering. So, but there's, she was saying, in effect, we says, I'm taking from what she said, I don't want to hold her accountable for what I'm going to say, is that when we're in pain, we have, generally speaking, the original pain and then further pain caused by our tightening around the pain, tightening against the pain. So in physical pain, we don't want it. And so we resist it or deny it. And that takes effort. And it generally makes things worse. Because tightness is painful when sustained. It's emotional pain, resistance to the physical pain I'm in, the situation of surgery, I'm dying, as my loved one is grievously ill. Resistance again takes extra effort, makes it worse. And the physical and emotional sides overlap, where I'm having this physical problem and I don't want to feel limited or invalid, as an invalid. So I deny the problem and I don't take it seriously as a messenger, and you know, cascades happen. But Annette said was that kind of suffering that is piled, that is the resistance to a pain, is extra, in a sense. It's enough. We're in pain. We add on this resistance to it. We add on a whole extra layer of suffering. So this has been called adventitious suffering. And meaning added on, not necessary, not essential to the original present. It's not the original presenting situation. But it's important not to see that those words as belittling the situation, because that's not the intention. To say that the suffering of our resistance to a pain, say whether it's physical or emotional, or that kind of resistance, we all know that. To say that that is adventitious and not to say that it's petty, my God, it's huge. And the body has a natural inclination to do that. So stop! Right? And sometimes it's a good thing for the body to do. But at any rate, it's a deep problem. The good thing about it being adventitious or not necessary, not essential, is that it you can do something about it. Something that comes can go. And that's really, in a way, one of the positive messages that runs through everything in Buddhism. We don't want to get hung up on saying, oh, the ego is such a problem. Off with the ego, off with its head. There, too, there is something about the problems of the ego not being so central. Oh, well, we don't want to have those. No, there are problems that are not essential can be dealt with. This is very positive. Not that you shouldn't have an ego, but you should see that the ways in which it is not a solid, you don't have a solid core ego self, that that's not the nature of it. It's good news. It doesn't mean it's petty. You wouldn't know how to live without an ego. You wouldn't know how to get along. You wouldn't know how to walk with your legs instead of your hands, I think. You know, it's maybe you would. Maybe the body itself would know that, but it wouldn't know how to find the door. Or how to turn the doorknob without a self that says, I'm here, that's a doorknob, this is what we do. A friend of mine said he's taking care of his grandson, and at 18 months or so, and we were talking about hands. I like hands a lot. I like my friend's hands. I even like my own hands. And he said, at 18 months, this kid, this baby, takes his hand. And the kid is wandering. He's a very adventurous little guy, and he's wandering off. And grandfather puts out his hand. The little kid turns and takes his hand. We have a. This is a beautiful thing. It also requires the beginnings of a sense of ego self. I'm here, this is a hand, that's you, it feels good to go there, join hand to hand. There's a like, this is like that. Those are, you know, ego's not a bad thing. Adventitious means, oh my God, maybe I can do something about it. we go so quickly to, I shouldn't be like that. You know, oh, that's, I shouldn't have resistance. Well, better get over that, you know. I haven't figured out that one yet, that's for sure. I think we have to get over the idea that I shouldn't feel like that. I shouldn't have that, because then we can't do anything about it. That's when we get enveloped in it. That's the great levels of psychological suffering. So there's Annette in the room with someone in a bed, or the family outside wringing their hands, or there's each one of us in our lives with a pain, physical or emotional, around which we have a resistance. So there are things we do about that in this practice. And there are in fact, you know, sort of how-tos, as there's the sort of our self-helping level of doing our practice, which is very important, because this pain is really happening right here. And I really want to do something concrete about it. So what do I do about it? We address the pain as a pain with all the modalities. We take it seriously, whether it's drugs or massage or acupuncture or surgery or just getting an x-ray and finding out what it is. The fear around the pain accentuates the pain. We do practices of accepting, this is my reality now. Once we can say, this is what it is, this is what I think I can do about it now, as we begin to do that, we can't really do that without saying, oh, this is my reality now. My shoulders are bad, my wrists are wearing splints. Oh, this is my reality now. It doesn't feel like me, but it is. When you think of how we do zazen, we don't do zazen as just letting things flow. Well, there's that aspect of it, because when we are participating in the movement and flow, we are participating in the impermanence and not resisting it. But one of the very interesting things to be doing in zazen is to be aware of the resistance to being part of the natural flow of things. So I want it to be this way. No, I had a real nice calm moment back there. I want to swim back upstream to it. Full resistance. So it's not just, there's on one side we say, you know, just let that go and allow the flow of life to happen. Then we say, just let that go and be here. There's a way in which we have to know that I'm here as this individual, as this flow. I'm not just flowing along. That's only one aspect of me. The very important, my way of being an individual is I'm here as this flow, and in the midst of this flow, accepting reality and resistance as they come up, not accepting them to say, oh well, but to say, oh, this is as it is. This is my pain. This is my resistance to my pain. And this is how I can meet these, or how I can hold these, and know that I can't completely deal with it. There's a time in zazen, it's very useful to do a zazen where you sometimes accept a limitation that you feel as a kind of pain. I'm not advocating hurting yourself or tough guy zen, but a sense of saying, oh, I can stay here anyway. If you have a sense that it's not harming, it feels uncomfortable, whether it's because I'd rather get up and go, or because I'm feeling uncomfortable, or I'm feeling emotional, I can stay here as it is. I don't have to switch away from the emotion. I don't have to switch away from the discomfort. I can say I'm here as it is. And out of that, we find something to do. This is the practice of no denial. Everything we do, even when it's acupuncture, when it's taking an antibiotic, when it's doing zazen, when it's lying down, resting, we can do them all as a way of suppressing and erasing, or we can do them all as part of accepting the reality of life. Our whole life is our practice. Whole life is a practice of no denial. It won't make it better always, won't make it go away. I am getting older. I am in fact aging. I've been getting older since I was born. Now I'm doing something called aging. Got to be a little bit more specific here, right? So now I'm doing something called aging. Oops, it feels different. So I have to accept the reality of not liking that as well as the reality of it happening in order to face up to it. I have to accept that in the next moment I can come to terms with it right now. But in the next moment I won't feel that way anymore. There's impermanence for you. Accepting that reality too. Everything we do is our practice life. Everything, we are always in, we can say, oh, we're always in the Dharma world. We're always in the world of impermanence and a new suffering coming up. That's the Dharma world too. It's all the Dharma world. So pain is a natural response. Right? It's a natural response to an attack on the body or mind. And an awareness of pain will naturally cause the pain of not wanting that pain. So being aware of pain is going to cause suffering. We call that, this kind of suffering, adventitious, to say, yes, suffering will come up when you pay attention to the fact that you're in pain and you can do something about it. In both accepting and removing. And they're not separate. Accepting and removing or remediating are also not completely separate things. We can remove pain, we can remove resistance, we can be present as pain flows. We can be peaceful in the midst of pain. We can be aware of suffering in the midst of pain. All of those. So, but physical pain is the simplest. It's not easy to bear. But in terms of our comprehension of it, it's simplest because we at least to some extent think we know what it is. As Edme was saying, we don't really know what it is. It's something much more complicated. We have pain, physical pain, where there isn't a so-called physical correlate out of there. I'm not even drinking that wine and I'm having all those nice flavors or the experience of vinegar. Some pain is like that. The more nuanced our sense of relating to pain, that it's not a little one simple one-to-one correlate, the easier it'll be to approach the second kind of suffering, which is our psychological suffering. And except when we are in active physical pain, I'd say our psychological suffering is usually a lot bigger in most people's lives most of the time, until a physical crisis washes over us. And even then, it's such a mixture of physical and psychological suffering. But again, provisionally separated out, to look at the psychological aspects of suffering, or quote, psychological suffering. Suffering not caused directly, shall we say, by physical pain, for the most part, by ideas and feelings and values and wishes and regrets, including regrets about, I wish I weren't aging right now, or I wish I didn't have this particular symptom of it. You know, give me some other symptom. Let me age without symptoms. You know, something like that. Because the aging is something I'm beginning to make a personal study of. But I wasn't interested until I developed some physical pain, right? That made me say, oh, there's something larger here, and it's interesting, and it's inevitable, and maybe if I pay attention to it, I'll understand something for myself and maybe even with others. So there's the pain of the aging body, and there's the psychological suffering of feeling the body and mind weakening and declining. And then there's the suffering of my identity being challenged and eroded by age's limitations. And even that's turned out to be very interesting. Where in our bodies do we identify our self happening most? I've been dealing with rotator cuff syndrome in both arms and tendonitis in the other, and this and the other, something else here and there. And Elska said, well, gee, you know, here you are waving your arms around all the time. You're using your arms all the time. You lead with your arms. I used to be a craftsperson. I love doing hand sewing, those robes, doing things with the hands, touching. Everything, you know, comes from here. Being strong. I'm strong. I don't think about being strong as involving my legs so much. I don't need to hike 5 miles or 10 miles. It's not where I put. So my identity around competence and strength and ability is all up here. Now they got arthritis and all these things are happening. And someone else has it in their legs. Elska was a dancer and was dancing and walking. And she used to travel around the world with a backpack, a little knapsack kind of a pack, for months at a time. Say fly somewhere and then be on foot. But that aspect of identity is eroding. So it's not just our physical being, but it's our very identity. It's very uncomfortable. I'm sure those of you who are paying attention to those same things happening are aware of that. So it's interesting. So paying attention to it is turning out to be very, it's happening anyway. So at least it could be an interesting trip. You know, there are things to be learned. So psychological suffering in Buddhism is often described, again, one of these nice little threesomes. This is the heritage of Indian Buddhism, which is very analytical. We have threes and fours and sixes and sevens. And Robert Thurman, the first book he ever published was his translation of the Malakirti Sutra. I think it was his doctoral thesis. And he has a whole index in the back called the ones, twos, threes, fours, fives, sixes, sevens, eights, nines, and tens, because it's such fun. Because there's so many sets. That's the Indian. They invented the mathematical set, infinity, zero, and a few other wonderful things. So there's the sense of a set. So we have a set for psychological suffering of the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion. And this is to say that it's not that emotion or feeling that is a poisonous source of suffering, but certain kinds of negative mental states. Desiring has gotten a, it's not all wanting and desiring that is harmful, except some schools of Buddhism it is, but certainly in the Mahayana it's grasping, and the original meaning grasping and thirsting after is suffering, and a lot of our wants and desires are or have a quality of that. And why are they suffering? Because they can't be satisfied. Because they are self-generating conditions. That's why this government is worried if we start saving money and stop spending. Because if we stop thirsting after goods, the economy is based on that. It's based on our delusion. So the suffering of unsatisfactoriness of life is experienced in terms of greed, in terms of hatred, and in terms of delusion, which really is the source of greed and hatred. We could leave it down to greed and hatred, really. The wanting and the wanting not. As something that is in itself self-renewing. It's not just, oh, here's a book I want. It's the wanting that is more powerful than the object. That's the recurring state that feeds on itself. Betty Midler wrote a children's book about a little girl. Betty Midler with lots of red curly hair, right? Bette Midler. So she wrote a children's book called More, about a little girl who looked remarkably like her. And I think the girl even just falls to earth from outer space, I'm not sure. Arrives here saying, more! I want more, whatever is offered. She wants more, more, more. It's a story of growing up as Bette Midler. It's a great roar of life. I want more. It's a great roar of suffering. Because it cannot, more is something that cannot be satisfied. It's a moreness. It's not this thing doesn't satisfy me because my need is not for this thing, but for more. That's the essence of greed. And hatred is the inverse. It's what everything we reject. We can say, oh, I don't hate. Well, everything that we reject, repulse, refuse, exclude, that's our expression of hatred. It's not the same as anger. Delusion is included because it is meaning. It's a nice grab bag word for all our ideas about ourselves as the center of the universe, which is the source of the idea of more, fee the center of the universe, and hatred. This is not good for the center of the universe over here and must be repulsed. That everything is in terms of this one. All three are attachment. The word I used at the beginning. Probably most of you know it as a Buddhist word. I'm attached to my ideas of life. I'm attached to my notions of myself, the good ones and the bad ones. It's not all positive. I'm attached to some nasty notions about myself, too. We all are, as well as some, really, the things we like to think we are. I'm attached to my notion of what the Zendo is about. And so are you. If I make a change, people say, what? That's not the way it's supposed to be here, my Zendo. Right? So we each have a separate Zendo we carry around with us. And we each have, you know, so many. These are all our attachments. Every view is attachment. And to live in terms of our attachments is great suffering. Now, but the difficulty for human beings is attachment is always mixed with caring. We don't usually just have some kind of a naked, raw attachment. Maybe Ayn Rand did, I don't know, in her books. But for the most part, it's kind of a... When I care, I'm attached to how what I care about does. You know? I care about that little guy, Caleb, so I have attachment to how he turns out, what he does with my caring, and, you know, all of that. And my heart and you are so much, in this, so much bigger the closer we are to somebody. So... all of our caring, everyone we care, everything and every person and every concept and every value that we care about, we then have an idea about how it should go, how it should stay, how it should be, how it should develop. Of course we do. And those are our attachments. Our mind creates attachments with remarkable facility. Just amazing. So as a human being, we're not going to have feelings, even. So I would say take all feelings. All of our feelings have... there's not that they are attachment and bad things, and we shouldn't love and care and all those things. Greed, hate, and delusion are negative states. Feelings are not themselves suffering in this sense. But even positive feelings have a shadow underside. The fear of letting go. Love. I love and I have a fear of being rejected or of losing what I love, or a fear of not loving well enough. All those are attachments. And they interfere with the actual connection of that love. Compassion for the world. Well, then there's when it turns to a despair because the problems are so huge, that's our attachment to an outcome. Attachment to there being a correct solution. Attachment to it getting fixed. And it interferes with our compassion, as we all know, because the despair is so painful that we retract away from what we want to have this compassion for. So this is what Yunmen saying, medicine and disease cover the earth. Say the medicine, the balm of compassion, and the disease of despair at remediating the enormity of the conditions. They cover the earth, they're not separate. The whole earth is medicine. So, and he's saying disease is an aspect of the medicine, not medicine is a response to a disease. That's the hopeful statement of Buddhism. That compassion is what is endlessly renewable, endlessly generable. And the other side, as we look, we can let go and we can drop off and we can see through, accepting that it's going to come up again. Because otherwise it's another attachment. Encouragement of Buddhism is that medicine is everywhere. Compassion, caring, seeing, waking, touching. Clinging keeps arising. And the ability to care about that is already here. That's what this koan is saying. The ability, the capacity for empathy, the capacity to care is already here. It may be hidden away in us as not appropriate to express. And so then if we can't express it, we hardly know it. The capacity is universally present. This is the whole earth is medicine. But in this whole earth that is medicine, disease endlessly comes up. Which is something for next week, that endlessly coming up, the deep origins of that. That's really that third kind of suffering we call existential suffering, the suffering of being a living being that comes with being a living being, aside from the particulars of our attachments and clinging. There's a deeper layer of our life there. The whole bodhisattva ideal and view. The bodhisattva ideal is here's an idea. Now, but there's attachment there. The idea that I should be like that, or I can't be like that, or it's too hard, or it's, you know, those are the disease aspect, or I can't. The fact is that the medicine of compassion, or the capability of caring and of sharing, is universal and is already part of our nature. Here's a quote that I found. I was very surprised at who said this. It says, "We are cups constantly and quietly being filled. Life and the world and many gifts are constantly and quietly coming and filling us. We are cups constantly and quietly being filled. The trick is knowing how to tip ourselves over and let the beautiful stuff out." I like that. The sage who wrote that is Ray Bradbury. Nice. I always liked his book, but I hadn't thought of him this. That. We empty ourselves out of all the beautiful things that have come in, all the things that come in, and all the attachments and all the ideas and all the how it should be. And we are then ready to be filled by the universe and to do this with each other. And this is, I think, a very lovely statement of the bodhisattva path. Maybe especially of the aspect of the bodhisattva path called compassion, called karuna, which is a particular kind, which is what compassion originally means, which is sharing the sorrow of or sorrowing at the suffering of others. That's karuna. There's always going to be suffering. We always have the capacity to be aware of it. We always have the capacity not to be bound by fear of the that it'll be catching, or that we won't be able, or that we'll be inundated by it, unable to meet it, or that we're supposed to meet it completely. All these ideas we have. The Bodhisattva's Karuna statement is, I will abide pervading the all-encompassing world with heart imbued with compassion, abundant and immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. I will abide together with all beings. Well, and then I'll say, oh my God, I can't do that. And that's my attachment to a certain idea of myself. It's just a direction, to go in the direction of being that kind of vessel that is always knows itself being filled by the universe and always knows itself pouring out, that always knows itself, therefore, available to be aware of suffering here, 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 and to have to share in it, to participate. Funny, you know, we know that for ourselves, when we're suffering, to have someone just actually be present with us, give us, do nothing else but that. A person who will give their entire attention to being with me at this time. So something is affirmed behind and beyond that suffering at that time. It's a great gift. And we know how all they're doing is being themselves present with us. And yet, when we want to meet someone else's suffering, we go into all these paroxysms of inadequacy. Those are our attachments. Let's empty them out. The not so beautiful and the beautiful stuff out. It all has to flow out so that more can flow in again. So the Buddhist values of ending suffering have nothing to do with escaping it or putting it out like smothering a fire. It's nothing to do with declaring war on yourself or other living beings or wrenching apart something that is clenched in suffering. Medicine covers the earth. We are the earth. When we know that, we know our natural self, then compassion can be present. Then we can meet suffering. I do have in my mind a double feature. You know what? They used to have double features in the movies. They don't do that anymore. Remember that? Double features. Well, the double feature is ignorance and the basic suffering of life itself. If you want to show up. It's our life. It's our tender life. Even if we talk about ignorance, if we talk about the deep suffering at the heart of our life and or what that is, we're talking about our own tender, soft flesh and our eagerly awakening beings. It's not something that we need to fear. Two things. We have a session in 10 days, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, the 7th, 8th, and 9th.